Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the hell happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war, before, during, and after war. So let's go.
Welcome to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where we have narrated war history episodes, and we also have episodes where we sit down with filmmakers, authors, historians, politicians, and we talk about wars and history. Today's guest is Colin Gorey. He has a PhD in linguistics, which is very unique. Haven't had that on the show yet. And that's also pretty rare. And he's known for hosting language workshops, and he's the author of the newsletter, The Dead Language Society, which I highly recommend. Go check it out. And today we're going to be talking about all sorts of cool stuff. We've got the Norman Conquest. We've got the Danelaw with the Vikings and a bunch of other stuff today. So, Colin, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So one of the really cool things that you can see in history is how all of these different periods throughout time can change language. Trade obviously has an impact, but there's war too. And some of these things are just kind of lost to history. Maybe people don't know why English sounds eerily similar to French. So we're going to be talking about that. Let's start with talking about how you want to bring linguistics out of the ivory tower. Tell us about that a little bit.
Well, I think language is one of these things that is really close to everyone. Everyone has a language that they speak, that they've grown up with, that's really close to their hearts. But at the same time, there are lots of things about language that we don't know. Or maybe even more accurate to say would be that we don't know we know. There are all sorts of interesting connections. And in fact, it's almost like being an archaeologist, being able to dig in the origins of words and understand that, words that we might take for granted, like, for example, the word Lord, probably comes up a lot. People studying war, they talk about, the Lord of this land, the Lord of that land. This is a really interesting etymology. If you break it up in Old English, it sounds a little different. It's hlavord, so two syllables. And when you split it in half, it's hlafward, which means loaf guard, the person who guards the bread.
Yeah.
And so all of this amazing history, and you can think, why would someone who guards the bread be the Lord?
And wow,
Well, actually, it does make a certain amount of sense, doesn't it? Because this is the person who is in charge of the food supply. This is what we're depending on for sustenance. Of course, we're going to be respectful and tip our hats to that person. So all of these things are hanging out in our everyday speech, and we might not know anything about them until we take a little look and see that, the traces of history are all over the words we say every day.
Yes, it is such a fascinating journey to go down, especially one of my favorites, all these different layers, is the Norman Conquest, where you're like, why are there different words for the same thing, but one is like fancy sounding, like with food, there's beef and, veal and, all these different things. And why is the one that we're eating as opposed to one that's the animals? They sound different. It has to do with this kind of thing. But first, let's bring it all the way back to Rome, everybody's favorite. So let's talk about things like Caesar conquering Gaul. And let's just kind of, can you kind of tell us a little bit about what the heck Gaul was, with especially language? And was it... So did Caesar bring a lot of Latin, or did the soldiers bring a lot of German back? And let's get into that.
Okay, so at the time of Caesar's campaigns in Gaul, the language spoken in most of that region, so Gaul, modern-day France, the language spoken in most of that region would have been a language called Gaulish, sensibly enough. And this is a Celtic language. So it's related to, say, Welsh, or Irish, or Scottish Gaelic, distantly but related. And even more distantly, it's related to Latin. And you can tell this because a lot of the... what the Latin word for king is rex, like the dog's name, Rex.
Yeah.
That's the word for king. Romans obviously don't love kings in most of their history after they overthrew the monarchy, but nevertheless, the word remains. And it gives us words like regal today. Kingly. That's another one of those pairs where we have the two words that mean roughly the same thing. We'll talk about that later.
Ooh, yeah.
But okay, we have the Latin word rex, which means king. The Gauls have a word rix, which means king, which you see in the names of all of these sort of chieftains that Caesar fights against, like Vercingetorix.
Rix. Ooh, yeah.
It's the same word. So this is one of the words that that the Celtic languages, even today, Irish, ri is the word for king in Irish. So you can see these connections. They all go back ultimately to a common ancestor. So even though by the time of Caesar, they wouldn't have recognized those similarities, modern linguists can look back and see, okay, that Gaulish and Latin are actually not so different in the end.
Interesting. And so how much, so we tend to think of, like, you know, you hear about the Franks and people that later were in that area, and you're kind of like, well, what, but they were Germanic, and how did that happen? What, that's a little bit of a confusing thing.
Okay, let's go from Caesar to, say, Charlemagne. Take all that history and condense it down, especially linguistically. So Caesar comes in, conquers Gaul, and at that time, Latin becomes introduced into Gaul. And it's used, especially in cities, and Gaulish is remains for quite a long time, especially in the countryside. So you have this sort of bilingual situation where you have Latin being spoken alongside Gaulish. And this happens and continues throughout the end of the Roman Empire. End of the Roman Empire in the West, I should say.
it's a tone debate.
don't get me started on that. But sort of alongside the end of that Western Empire, and to a certain extent causing it, we have the migrations of Germanic speaking peoples in from modern day Germany, but also Scandinavia. And so these are peoples who are speaking an ancestor of the English language, also an ancestor of the German language, and ancestor of Dutch, ancestor of Swedish. All these languages would not have been distinguished at this point. And so they were all speaking more or less mutually comprehensible dialects of some early Germanic language. And these Germanic peoples are mentioned a lot in Roman sources. The Romans fought against them a lot. They have this sort of frenemy sort of relationship with the Germanic peoples, especially the Franks are a good example. But the Goths are another good example. Were Roman allies sometimes, Roman enemies sometimes. They sacked Rome on one memorable occasion. But really what the Goths and the other Germanic peoples wanted was sort of more of a piece of the pie than to destroy Rome. Because if you destroy Rome, that's kind of like killing the golden goose.
This
is where all this wealth is flowing up from the Mediterranean up into Northern Europe. So they want a piece of this pie, but unfortunately, they end up killing the golden goose. And as a result, the Roman hegemony over Western Europe becomes broken, and it becomes replaced by these successor kingdoms, which are often ruled by Germanic speakers. And the Franks are one of these groups. And they come in and they create their kingdom in what was Gaul, and after them is now called France.
Yes.
Francia.
Yes.
The land of the Franks. But they spoke a Germanic language similar to, actually ancestral to modern Dutch. That's the closest
Dutch. All right. Interesting. So we're talking about, in the area of France eventually became this Germanic kind of speaking area. But going back when Caesar was there, it was this like Celtic kind of thing that wasn't Germanic yet.
So we have these three layers. We have the Celtic layer, then the Latin layer, and then on top of that, the Germanic layer. But each time it's never a complete replacement. So when the Romans come in, Latin becomes established and more people speak it eventually, but Gaulish never dies out during that period. It's always spoken, especially in the countryside. And then the Franks come in, but the Franks are not numerous enough to impose their language over everyone. So they can impose their language in the places that are already mostly Germanic speaking. The Netherlands as an example, but they can't really impose their language over all of France. And so what happens is you get a shift where they adopt the language of the conquered people.
Yeah.
And
oh,
it's
interesting.
Only when the Franks come in that Gaulish eventually dies out and you get more or less an ancestor to French, which is formed in the crucible of
all these things.
Latin speaking Gauls and Franks trying to understand each other. And so as a result,
crazy.
French is very different from Latin.
Yeah, I remember going down the rabbit hole of like, what even is French made of? You go like, sure, it's a Latin language, you know, but like, what, how much of that? And you go into it and you're like, oh my God, so there's all this German in there, and there's Celtic in there for sure, and like Arabic, and there's all these mishmashes of things in there that are so different from Italian or something like that. So that's really cool, this history behind how that happened. And some of it was war. A lot of it sounds like war, and a lot of it sounds like kind of just regular migration, economic migration too. That's interesting. So the Caesar and his army were there for like 20 something years. Did they bring a substantial amount of any language back, or is it just like, might as
back
well
back to
been.
Rome from Gaul?
Yeah. Like did that language flow into Rome a little bit, or change anything in Latin a little bit?
It didn't flow so much into the Latin spoken in Rome.
Okay.
There is one word that I can think of, which is ambactus, which becomes the word ambassador.
Oh!
Which I think comes from Gaulish. But where it has an influence is more in the spoken Latin of Gaul.
Okay, that's cool.
Because the Latin as it's spoken and the Latin that you learn in school are two different things.
Yeah.
Just like the English you read in the newspaper and the English people actually speak could be very different from place to place. And
yeah.
So Latin was no different. There was a spoken version of Latin which had all of its slang and all of its particular ways of expressing things and pronouncing things, often affected by the local language that was there before Latin.
Mm.
And that'd be different in different places. And so there would have been a certain influence of Gaulish on that Latin as it was spoken in Gaul.
Okay. And before we move on from the Franks entirely, you called their linguistic legacy like a paradox. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's a paradox in this sense. You would expect that a conquering people would be able to impose its language on the conquered people. But instead, what happened was that the conquerors were conquered, linguistically speaking. And so they end up speaking French. They were, in a way, a victim of their own success because they conquered huge, vast swaths of territory, but couldn't populate it with Frankish speakers, and maybe didn't even want to necessarily. So they ended up adopting the language of the people that they were ruling, which was this early form of what we'd later call French.
That is interesting. That is so fascinating. And then, of course, the French change English later. So this really is all these wheels of fortune, you know.
And there are words that go back and forth between them, back and forth between Germanic and Romance and Germanic and Romance over and over again. It's quite wild. But what's really interesting about French in particular, when you look at French now, you're actually seeing a language that's more Latin-like than French would have been in the Middle Ages.
Uh-huh.
Because during the Renaissance, French underwent a process of sort of de-Germanification. So they got rid of a lot of the words that they had taken from Frankish. There are still many, but they got rid of a lot of them and replaced them with words that they reborrowed from Latin. Because during this entire time, Latin was still a language that was used, more of a classical style of Latin because of the church.
Uh-huh.
So they still had this access to Latin. And so you get cases where there are words that are from the sort of spoken slang, everyday street Latin, and the fancy book Latin words coexisting in French for that
reason. Right. And we are going to talk a little bit about that later. This is a really cool topic. Okay. So let's kind of get out of that a little bit and go over to the Vikings and England. Everybody knows a little bit about this, but I think that a lot of people would be surprised to know that there was such a thing called the Danelaw, which was freaking huge. Seriously, go look up a map if you've never heard of it before. This thing is like, it looks like it takes up half of England. So can you tell us what the heck that was, what was going on there? What languages were there?
Okay,
and when we're talking about.
Yeah, let's cross the channel now. Mm. And we're looking at what's now modern day England. Now, during Roman times, this was also occupied by the Romans. And a very similar situation happened there as happened in Gaul. So there was a Celtic language spoken there. And it had started to become replaced, at least, especially in cities, with Latin. But never completely replaced. Mm. And what happened when the empire fell, or was the process of it falling, was that the Romans withdrew from Britain and they withdrew their protection as well. And so it's debated exactly what circumstances were that led to this, but what happened was Germanic peoples also crossed over into what would be later called England. And these peoples were called traditionally the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes.
Right.
But the best way to think about them is a collection of tribes from sort of southern Denmark and into maybe that northwestern part of Germany.
Yeah.
And they crossed over and they essentially established their dominion. And in their case, the language won out. So there was a language shift in this region of southern Britain, which would be called England after them. Mm. And the Celtic language went away, or at least became limited to the far western fringe, what we call Wales and Cornwall today.
Right.
So these are the descendants of the speakers of that Celtic language, or at least linguistic descendants of the speakers of that Celtic language that was in Britain before Latin. And so you have these Germanic speakers, and they speak a variety of dialects, but they're more or less mutually comprehensible. After a little while, they start to form a collective identity as what they called English, after the name of one of their tribes, which were the Angles.
Yeah.
And then eventually they come to call themselves, in Latin at least, the Anglo-Saxons. They never called themselves that in English, though.
Right.
But that was this sort of a political identity that was adopted because they were soon joined, after a few centuries, they were joined by other Germanic-speaking peoples, the Danes. Mm-hmm. So these are Scandinavians from Denmark and Norway, depending on where you are in Britain. You know, it's sort of whatever the closest one to you, that's who you're going to get raided by.
And of course.
These people are the people we know as the Vikings. Viking is a word that more or less translates to pirate.
Yeah.
So it's not that all of the people in Scandinavia were Vikings, but if you were in England, the ones you would encounter would be Vikings.
Yes, yes.
And so this starts to happen in the late 8th century and continues until sort of the mid 11th century. So we're thinking around 790 to 1066. We'll talk about that year, why it's so particular in a second.
Super big year, yeah.
But that's really the last gasp of these Scandinavian incursions into England. And what happens is that they really wipe the floor with the English for a long time. Until you get to the reign of a king named Alfred the Great. And he was a king of one of the kingdoms. So England wasn't unified at this time. He was the king of one of the kingdoms, which is called Wessex. Wessex means West Saxons. So he was the king of that group. And he essentially brought the Danes to brought their expansion to a halt. And sort of formalized relations with them and said, okay, let's come up with a way. I mean, he fought them quite a bit too.
But oh, yeah.
In the end, he came up with a treaty which established Danish law over part of England and Danish rule.
Yeah.
And this part is called the Dane Law for that reason. It's the part
Naturally.
Of England in which Danish law held sway.
Yeah.
And in fact, the word law itself is a Danish loanword.
Cool.
Yeah, it means that which is laid down.
Cool. That's so fascinating. So So it was a way to put somewhat of a final end to all of these like constant invasions and incursions from the north. So I'm really interested to know how much English was spoken in the Danelaw. Was it English with Danish influences, or was it Danish with English influences? What are we talking about?
So the raiding that happened gave way to settlement. So the first Danes that came were just interested in stealing things and burning things. Mm. And, you know, that sort of the pillaging lifestyle.
Classic.
But before too long, they began to settle as well. And so the Danelaw had a mixture of speakers of English, Old English, so a very early form of English, one that we're not able to comprehend when we hear it or read it today.
Yeah, I know.
And Old Norse, which is the language that the Danes spoke. And so these were spoken side by side with each other. And they were, it's debated whether the two would have been able to understand each other easily, but with some effort, they would have been able to understand each other, because these languages are both Germanic languages. They're not so distant from one another. They have different endings, but most of the words are recognizable. And so if you're living with neighbors who speak this language, you could probably work out a way of communicating. And perhaps your son might marry one of their daughters. And, you know, after a while, the communities start to blend together and words start to pass back and forth. Now, in the end, the English language won out because the Danelaw came to an end and English rule was established over that territory once again, but there was a lot of Danish influence that remains in the English as spoken in those regions. And place names are a really big tell for where the Danelaw was. Actually, you can make a map and you look for certain place name elements, like place names that end in B, B-Y.
Okay.
This comes from an Old Norse word meaning settlement. And basically, anywhere you see that B-Y, probably the Danelaw.
Oh, wow. That's really cool. Interesting. Yeah,
like Grimsby, the settlement of the Grim One.
Oh my God. That is so cool. Wow. Okay. And so in the areas where the Danelaw was, can you today see a difference in maybe the dialect spoken in that part of England where it's like, that sounds a little bit influenced by the Norse?
You can. So the problem is we're in this age of mass communication now. So it's a lot of these traditional dialects have unfortunately receded or died out.
Okay.
But if you look back at old recordings or speak to old people who are, you know, maybe old rural people who haven't traveled a lot, you might hear some of these things. There are some words that that have stuck around, especially in places like Yorkshire. That would be a part of the Danelaw.
Do you have any examples?
I'm wondering if, there's one caveat, which is that the dialect that of English that was spoken there is actually quite similar to Old Norse. So it's sometimes hard to discern beforehand.
Yeah.
But I can give you tons of examples of words that came into modern English, the English that we speak, that are of Old Norse origin.
Love to hear it.
So one example is basically any word that has an SK at the start. So sky. As an example, sky, skirt, skull. These SK words did not exist in Old English by and large, but they did in Old Norse. So all of these, almost all these skull words come from Old Norse. Words that end in G are very frequently from Old Norse, like egg.
Oh.
Yeah, the word egg is an Old Norse form. In Old English, if we had maintained the Old English version, we'd call them E's.
Oh my God, that's so, that's not as good as egg.
It's not as good as egg, although it had a cool plural form. So this is something that the first printer in England, William Caxton, tells an anecdote about. He's worried about, you know, standardizing what form of the language he's going to print. And he tells an anecdote about talking someone who's ordering eggs at an inn or something. And he says, Eggis. Do you mean... sorry, I don't speak French, is essentially what they say, because they don't know what he's saying. Because for them, the word for egg is Eiren.
So what?
Which would have become that E form that I was mentioning before. So it may have been E in the singular and Eiren in the plural, which might redeem the word a little bit for you.
Oh, a little bit,
like,
but
has
still
that
not
same
as good.
Plural as children.
Oh, I see. Weird. Yeah. Oh, that's so weird. I mean, it makes sense, but like, I'm glad that egg won out, because okay, so I remember reading about how there's this interesting layer of different words for kind of the same concept, and you could see some of it being Danish and some of it being English, kind of like sick and ill, or I'm drawing a blank on like other stuff right now. But is that normal, or is that just like a weird thing that happened with English and Norse, or is that kind of just something you see everywhere?
Everywhere where you see this contact. And so you also see this contact in places like, you know, East Asia, for instance. Japan had contact with Chinese, which was a prestigious language for them. It's the language of high culture for a long time. And so Japanese has taken a lot of words from Chinese, but at the same time, they've also retained Japanese words. And sometimes they'll have this situation where you get two words that roughly refer to the same context, same concept rather, but you use them in different contexts because one has a more sort of lofty feel to it, or more formal feel to it. An example for English would be this kingly, regal distinction.
Ooh, yeah.
Or brotherly, fraternal. Like these words mean the same thing technically, but you would use them in very different contexts. And this is part of the richness that comes with this language context situation, where you have options. You can sort of dial up or down the formality depending on which one of those words you use.
Right. Or like sisterhood versus sorority or something like that. Like, that is interesting. Well, I guess, so that brings me to the Norman conquest. So we're jumping forward in time a little bit. The year 1066, big year for England. Tell us a little bit about what was going on with the language, at least, with that.
So prior to 1066, the political power in England, outside of the Danelaw for the period when it existed, was held by kingdoms and rulers who spoke early forms of English. So a form that we call Old English. And for literature fans, this is the language that Beowulf is written in, which is a very great poem and a lot of fun. They spoke, you know, a little less of a poetic form, perhaps, but they spoke Old English. After 1066, the rulers of England come to be speakers of a form of French called Norman French, which is an interesting side story. The Normans themselves are a group of people who spoke French, but they are the descendants of Vikings as well.
Right, the Northmen, Norman,
Exactly, and so what the French did was more or less the same as what Alfred did in England, granted them an area where they could rule, and the deal was, you stop raiding us, sit down, rule there, that's your land, and protect us from your friends back home. But it worked out in that case. And due to some dynastic entanglements, the Normans, specifically William of Normandy, has a claim to the English throne. And when the King of England, Edward the Confessor, dies without an heir, then there's a scramble. And a local family of potentates in England claim the throne. A Dane claims the throne, and William of Normandy claims the throne. And so there's a lot of fighting. And in the end, the one who wins out is William of Normandy, AKA William the Conqueror, because he conquered at the Battle of Hastings in 1066. And when he takes over, he brings in all his buddies from Normandy, who speak an early form of French called Norman French. And they take over and they remake the government in the language of French. And so all of the scribes that were trained under the old regime, they get replaced by French scribes. The people who are in charge of everything get replaced by French speakers. And as a result, English kind of goes underground to a certain extent at this time, because this is not an age of mass literacy, not an age where writing is particularly cheap to do and producing books. So as a result, we don't have a lot of English texts from this period when the French are on top of the heap.
It's a bummer.
It's a bummer. We have a few and we can sort of guess what's going on, but it's not until a few hundred years later in roughly the 1400s where we start to get this real resurgence of English literature and people like Chaucer. And the Canterbury Tales and and it's a book that some people may have heard of. But during that period when the French are in charge, English changes too. It's just a little bit harder to see. So English starts to take on a lot of the aspects of French, a lot of vocabulary from French. And it also, because it's no longer standard language, there's no one keeping it the way it was. When the English speakers were ruling and they were producing their laws in English and things like that, they had an incentive to sort of write in a particular way. And there was a standard. And not a standard in the sense that we have today where, you know, there's mass education and people are taught to spell and speak in a particular way. But there was a greater deal of uniformity in the writing. And so if you were from a different part of the country, you would be trained to write in one dialect, the West Saxon dialect, because of Alfred, basically. And that goes away when French becomes used. So the French is all very nice and standard, but the English is wild. Every dialect is different. It changes relatively rapidly. And so when it reemerges to be called Middle English now, as opposed to Old English, it's very different from Old English. Grammatically, a lot of the endings have been lost and a lot of new French words have come in. And as a result, you can really quite easily read Middle English. Whereas
that's the Shakespeare, that's the Middle English kind of that you're talking about.
Shakespearean's a little bit later. Shakespeare is early modern English. There's an event that happens roughly the start of printing that matches it off. That's the historical event that you can point to in the late 15th century. But also there's a big linguistic change, which is called the Great Vowel Shift, that sets these two. These two apart. So basically the Great Vowel Shift is the vowels of Middle English actually made sense. So you speak some other languages, perhaps some other European languages?
Yes. Yeah.
So you know how when you're learning other languages and you have to learn that the vowel that we spell A and we say A is not A.
Yeah.
Why does that A sound A in English? Well, it's because of the Great Vowel Shift, where all of the pronunciations of a particular set of vowels radically changed. And so English spelling, unfortunately, was standardized before that happened. So it's a bit of a, you know, bad luck on our part. But but that's what we use to mark the difference between Middle and Modern English. And so Shakespeare is just on the other side of that line. So his stuff is even more comprehensible to us. But if you read Chaucer, say the Canterbury Tales, it's a lot more easy to understand than if you hear it. If you hear it, well, what's going on here? because all those vowels have changed between then and now. But if you read it, okay, I recognize these words. A lot of the same words that we use now. And the grammar is very similar.
Things like, remembering my lessons from that, where things like wife used to be weef, and I drawing a blank on, are there other examples of like this vowel shift that you can give us?
Right. So a good example would be name would have been nam or nama.
Okay. That makes sense.
Wife would have been weef. House would have been hus.
Right.
Okay. There are a few others of those, but those are the ones that are the most striking.
So reading it, you're like, I get what this is all about. And hearing it, you're like, what are you saying to me right now?
Exactly.
So the Norman Conquest, 1066, over time, we're talking like all of the laws had to be written in French. And all of the, anytime you went to court or did anything officially, it was French. And that was like all the nobility, the English nobility kind of got kicked out of their positions and replaced by Frenchmen. And the lofty, higher, upper class all spoke French. So English is a Germanic language because of the rules about how it goes together, how to use words, and because of its origins. But what do you think about the estimates that English words themselves are like 30-something percent French, 30-something percent Latin, which means the majority of our words are Latin-based? Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's the precise numbers you could probably debate endlessly.
Yeah.
But basically, yes, that's correct. But the devil's in the details because it depends on how you count words. So if you open up a dictionary of English and you just count words and find their origins, then you will see statistics like that. However, if you go through the words that people actually speak by frequency, it's a very different picture. Because almost all of the most common words are core Germanic words.
Interesting. You know, okay.
To eat, you know, all core Germanic. But if you say something like government priorities advance education, those are all going to be either French or Latin.
So see the lofty words. Yeah, that is very interesting. And that, okay, so then that brings us to the idea of vulgar, which is such an interesting concept. I'd love to ask you about that a little bit, where you have like, you're studying the etymology of a word, the origin of where words come from, and you're like, this is vulgar Latin, vulgar English. Tell us about that. What are we looking at here?
So vulgar Latin is one of these, it's a very useful term, but it sometimes gets you in trouble with people because they don't like it. I'll outline what it means first, and then I'll outline why some people don't like it. So vulgar Latin refers to the spoken Latin. So vulgus in Latin just means sort of the rabble, the common people. So vulgar means popular, common, everyday. And so it's a way to distinguish the kind of Latin that gave rise to the Romance languages versus the kind of Latin you study in Latin class, Caesar and Cicero. And there are some pretty substantial differences in vocabulary, pronunciation, and just sort of sentence construction between these two. But you can consider it like very similar to how different English is if you take an exact literal record of what someone says versus if someone sits down and wants to write a formal academic article.
Okay.
It's going to be very different. The pronunciation will be different, more casual in speech. There will be different words used. There will be different, you know, a lot less complexity of grammar from the point of view of, you know, how many clauses are you stacking next to each other to make this big sentence. In speech, people tend to say, and then, and then, and then, and then.
Right, right.
Notwithstanding the, in as much as we, you know, these sorts of very, very written constructions that you see. So the Latin was similar. And the spoken version is what people refer to as vulgar Latin. The reason some people don't like that phrase is it gives the impression that the aristocrats were speaking only the finest Latin, which is probably not the case. They were
top
also normal
Latin
people. So they may have had their different, you know, different diction, but it's not that they didn't have any of these features of spoken Latin. So that's why people sometimes say, oh, don't use the word vulgar Latin, but it's very clear what it means, so I still use it.
Because you're right. It does give across that thing of a class divide where you're like, oh, the people are on the street speaking this version, and then up in the mansion or whatever, they're speaking enough. But that wasn't really the case, is what you're saying. Like, that's not what vulgar is.
Right. It's in all likelihood, even aristocrats were speaking, had features in their speech that we associate with vulgar Latin.
And do you see this across other non-Latin languages? Like there's a formal way of speaking or writing Welsh as opposed to just on the street. Like is that universal?
It's universal wherever there's a kind of literary culture. So what happens with literary cultures is people really fixate on the usage of a particular author and a particular time. So you see this, I'll use an example from the other side of the world, use China as an example. So China had a form of the language which is called classical Chinese. And it is based on the language as it was written at a particular time in ancient China around the time of Confucius. And in fact, Confucius's works are some of the ones that people look to and imitate to create this written standard of the language that continues over the centuries. But at that time, it's probably not something that anyone speaks. It's a written form only, and then their speech is more vulgar Chinese or spoken vernacular Chinese. But because it's not written, we don't know a lot about it.
Okay.
Until the very, very modern period when people say, why are we doing this? Why do we have this completely different way of writing from speaking? And so then they start to write more like they speak.
Interesting.
That movement happens. So you see this in China. You see this in Europe with the rise of the vernaculars. Mm-hmm. So Dante being one of the first to say, hey, this is actually this language that we speak that's not Latin is worth writing in. We can call it Italian.
Those are interesting. And okay, so before we close off anything, I do want to talk a little bit about just war in general, where there is, you see language shifts from war and conquerings and all, these are huge events. But you also see language shifts from intermarriage and trade and things. Would you say that one, trade versus war, one is more influential in language shifts than the other? Are they kind of, no way to know?
Well, it depends on what happens with the war. So if a war is fought and then you get a status quo, no territory changes hands, then you may get some particular words come in from that war, but it's not likely to create a huge change.
Okay.
However, if you get conquest as a result of war, then you start to see, I mean, we saw this example talking about the Franks and with the Normans. Now, in both of those cases, their language didn't end up winning out, but it had an effect on the other language. Yeah. In the case of the English, the birth of the English language, the Celtic languages ended up losing out in favor of what would become Old English. Mm. So it can go either way, but there's often an effect of the, even of the language that didn't sort of make it. And the reason for that is because there's a hierarchy of the two languages. There's one that sort of got the power and one that doesn't. But what happens is, you know, even the rich people who have the power need someone to take care of their kid. And maybe that person is a native speaker of the language that's not so prestigious. And that's the kid learns all sorts of words from their nanny. And then that kid grows up and thinks, well, there's nothing wrong with those words. And they pass them along to their kids. And so this can happen as well. Or you might get situations where one group, a member of the conquering people, marry, or maybe not marry, but end up having children in some way, not always in a positive way necessarily, but with members of the conquered people. And this is something that people talk about perhaps happening in the distant prehistory of Europe a lot. Mm. And as a result, you know, there are concessions made, there are accommodations. One person tries to speak the other person's language, maybe does it imperfectly, and then passes that imperfect understanding of the language onto their children, and things change that way. So there are many different opportunities for language to change through conquest. Not all lovely to think about, but they, you know, they happen.
Yeah.
Trade, on the other hand, is not as hierarchical. It results in situations which are not as hierarchical. Now there's certainly often a hierarchy, but what you get with trade is often the emergence of pidgin languages. And a pidgin language is a language that sort of, you know, I don't speak your language, you don't speak my language, but neither one of us is in charge here. I can't make you speak my language.
Okay.
You can't make me speak yours. What we want to do is trade, and so we'll make do. I'll learn a few of yours, you learn a few of mine. And we'll have a very kind of make-do language that we can get along with to trade. Then what happens is often you will get children who grow up hearing that and they flesh it out into a what's called a Creole language.
Uh-huh.
And so then you can get things that are kind of like more full-fledged languages, so to speak. I hesitate to say full-fledged languages because, you know, who's to say, but... but this can happen, and this happens often through trade.
That is so are there any like widely used pidgin languages around that just kind of took root?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are. One of them. I'd have to ponder my geography, but I'll give you some names. Tok-Pisin is a widely spoken pidgin language. It means talk pidgin.
Oh my god.
Pidgin is thought to come from the word business. So talk business.
That's really interesting.
So that is spoken today, I think fairly widely, but for the life of me, I can never remember where.
Yeah. And for our listeners out there, we're not talking pigeon, the bird. It's like P-I-D-G-E-N or something like that. Pigeon,
yeah,
is that?
P-I-D-G-I-N.
So not spelled like the bird, and we're not talking about the bird. That's a different thing. That's interesting. It definitely sounds like conquest and war has somewhat of an impact, but it feels like languages evolve more lastingly through necessity or just person-to-person interactions of trade or just marriage or whatever relationships. That is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And
because as we see, even French stopped being spoken in England. And war actually had a part to play in that, because the English were, well, they lost Normandy eventually.
Mm.
Under the reign of King John.
Yeah.
For which reason he's not very popular, among others. Then the English fought the French again in the Hundred Years' War. And as a result, they started to come up with their own sort of separate identity. And this aristocracy that had been speaking French, they're also speaking English for a long time, too.
Mm-hmm.
And hey, aren't we all English? Why aren't we speaking French? So then you start to get this resurgence of English identity that leads into the English Renaissance and the era of Shakespeare and all this kind of thing, and the really efflorescence of English literature once again.
And wasn't that Edward III that was like, hey, I'm going to actually give speeches in English and I'm going to make English the official language? And it was kind of controversial, but kind of popular, but kind of controversial at a time to make English the official language of England. Something like that.
I forget. I don't remember the dates on that, but there was one point when Parliament started to accept speeches in English, and that's a sort of watershed moment.
Interesting.
English as a language of power once
again. Yeah.
And like you said, it's like really never given it up.
Yeah. You take it as a given now. Oh, English is spoken in England, but it wasn't always that way, and it wasn't so clear cut, and very interesting. Okay, so before we close off here again, I'd like to talk about huge debates on whatever topic my guest has an expertise in. So the big general debate in linguistics is, what are your thoughts on the prescriptive versus descriptive language debate? Is language laid out and kind of changes over time? That's how we should do it. Or does it just go however we say it should go? And that's how we make it.
Okay, so this is an interesting debate, and I don't know if I have the same opinion as most linguists, so I'll lay it out and see what people think. So, as I think we have to distinguish between two approaches to language. Linguists study language more or less in a scientific fashion, as a sort of objective study that they don't have opinions about, they're not trying to control. It's not engineering, it's science. So, you know, you don't really involve yourself in trying to make it go one way or another. You're just interested in what's going on. And as a result, you end up taking a descriptive approach, as you would for anything else that you're studying scientifically. And as a result, linguists have become associated with this descriptive approach to language. And it's something that we often teach in introductory linguistics classes, because most people come into a linguistics class, say if they encounter for the first time in university, basically not knowing what it means to study language scientifically.
Okay.
And so they might think, oh, this is about, you know, they're just going to try and correct me for putting prepositions at the end of the word. No, that's not really what we're doing. We're interested in what goes on so that we can understand more deeply what goes on in the human mind or in society or in history. We want to understand these things. And so as a result, you don't interfere with the experiment. However, the prescriptive approach to language is something that I think everyone has. We all have opinions about language. So prescriptive, saying language should be this way or shouldn't be this way. And this could even be a small matter of taste. You know, I don't like the way that this sounds. I'd prefer it to be like this. And all linguists do this. All linguists have this. This is the sort of the citizen approach to language rather than the scientist. You're a citizen of the Republic of English, you know, as an English speaker. And so you have opinions about how it should go, and you have opinions about what you like about what's going on now and what you don't like. And everyone has those opinions, including linguists, but they try and, I think, ideally set them aside when they're doing their scientific work.
Right. So interesting.
So I'm a descriptivist about prescriptivism, you might say. I'm just like, it exists and we have to accept it, but we have to be mindful of when we're using it and whether it's appropriate to do so.
Yes. And one of the more recent examples of this kind of like blur over what even is language is the word literally, which has for a very long time. So the definition was always like word for word, you know, like no other interpretation or exaggeration or whatever, it's word for word. But for a very long time, we're just kind of, oh, literally the biggest pizza I've ever seen, or, you know, like we just use it in a non-literally way. And now it means not literally. And so it's like that kind of thing of like, should we describe how it happened or should we just say, no, don't do this? And it's an interesting debate, you know.
There's also an element of futility in a lot of these things. Like by the yeah. time that people get upset about them, they're almost like a fait accompli.
Yeah.
What can you do? It's already happened. So you can, you know, write a letter to the editor or something. But other than that, history is not likely to be with you.
Yeah, yeah. The dictionary's like, we're just telling you what somebody might mean, not telling you what you have to think of it. We're just like giving you, you know, something to understand. That's interesting. Okay. So what can people... what kind of eras or what kind of things can people learn about in your newsletter, the Dead Language Society, and your workshops too?
So what I cover with the Dead Language Society is the entire sweep of the history of English, from the present day, going all the way back into prehistoric times, all the way back to this hypothetical ancestor language, Proto-Indo-European. So it's a big 6,000 year sweep of history. A lot of interesting stuff happens in it. And I give myself a little wiggle room. I say, a guided tour through the history of the English language and its relatives. So I've got lots, my beat is pretty broad.
Yeah.
So I can still talk about things like French because I enjoy doing that as well. But just due to the, due to my own particular interests, I focus a lot on the Old English period, which is, I think, a period that needs to be better understood by modern English speakers because it's there where we see a lot of the roots of our language. So this is that pre-1066 period where you get the literature like Beowulf and the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, a lot of amazing poetry. It's a beautiful period that I think it does take a little bit of training to learn to read it, but
it's different. It's hard.
To do.
Yeah. Yeah. That's cool. Okay, well, thank you so much again for Colin Gorey. Thank you so much again for coming on the show and answering all these language questions. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much, Emily. It's been a pleasure.
All right, bye.
Bye.